Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Intelligence is very much in the news these days, including, evidently, the wholesale compromise of much of our intelligence capabilities, at least in the electronic espionage space. Who better to talk to about that than a former Central Intelligence Agency senior official, Charles Sam Faddis, an extraordinary individual who has contributed mightily through his time in government to our security, notably as an operations officer in the clandestine services of the Central Intelligence Agency for some 20 years, also as the chief of the agency's Weapons of Mass Destruction Terrorism Unit. He is also the author of numerous books, including the relevant Beyond Repair, The Decline and Fall of the CIA. Sam Faddis, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Hey, it's great to be here, Frank. Thank you very much.
Well, I'd like to get your reaction to the latest releases out of WikiLeaks, which seem to be compromising quite a bit of our sources and methods of intelligence in the highly technical space. Give us your thoughts on what's been done here and a damage assessment, if you can.
Yeah, well, the damage is potentially catastrophic. I mean, without trailing off into details of stuff we can't talk about, I guess this seems like a game to some people at WikiLeaks and other folks in the press, but it's not. Once we compromise techniques, we lose access, we lose intelligence, and the bottom line is people get killed as a consequence.
Lose lives. That's the point. This is another of these cases where when you hear about Samsung TVs being turned into collection devices and people being able to end run Signal and other encryption phone services, that immediately begin playing to fears that the CIA is using such techniques against us, infringing upon our privacy. As a longtime employee of the agency, what would you say to those concerns? And in particular, Sam, would you talk a little bit about the high likelihood, if not before now, certainly by now, other foreign entities are almost certainly making use of such techniques for the purpose of collecting against us?
Right. Well, as you know, I'm a big believer in privacy and individual rights. But the reality is, I mean, the Central Intelligence Agency is not running around collecting intelligence on American citizens. First of all, its charter is outside the United States. And your point is dead on. Every competent intelligence service in the world, certainly all the ones we're worried about, the Russians, the Chinese, et cetera, all have these kinds of capabilities. I mean, the bottom line is if you're sitting in a room with an electronic device and it's connected to a cell network or the internet and you think you are immune to being accessed, you're delusional. I mean, that you don't want somebody listening, get out of the room with the device.
Yeah. Even devices that are off, it seems, are subject to some of this kind of manipulation. So it's a challenge. The device has got to be someplace else, whether you're in the room or not. Let me ask you, Sam, about something you've written about recently, the surveillance of Donald Trump by what has come to be called the deep state. As, again, a former denizen of that enterprise, do you find credible the contention by the president that he was, in fact, surveilled by his predecessor? And what would you make of that from a point of view of privacy and the freedoms that we hold dear?
Well, if it's true, it's certainly very, very disturbing. And we're talking probably about criminal activity. I don't know enough about it to know what the basis is of that claim. I will say in regard to the deep state, I think it is undeniably true that we now, in effect, have a fourth branch of government composed of unelected officials. And instead of simply taking orders, they are trying to drive policy and they are trying to control the government themselves. That's incredibly disturbing because at the end of that road is the end of democracy if we keep going.
Well, and Donald Trump would simply be one of its victims in that case. I fear you're exactly right. Sam, you've also written about the ascendancy of Iran as a result of Barack Obama's policies. We'll be talking more about this momentarily with colleague Carolyn Glick as well, but I'd like to get your thoughts on the implications of that ascendancy.
Terrifying, in a word. We adopted a policy in 1979 after the fall of the Shah of containing the Iranians, confronting them at various points, playing with the idea of regime change. We have now abandoned that, and as a consequence, all across the Middle East, they are ascendant. And it is terrifying for our allies, incredibly destabilizing for the region. We have got to get this balance of power back where it needs to be and push the Iranians back in their box, or we are, in fact, going to end up in a war with them.
Do you anticipate, you've just answered that question, that this isn't just a problem for our friends and regional interests. This is, in fact, a security threat to us as well.
Yeah, without question, it is a security threat to us. I mean, it is a massive strategic problem. This is not a small war somewhere that we can kind of pick or choose whether we want to pay attention to it. This is destabilizing in one of the most critical regions on the planet.
And is that of particular concern, given your background with weapons of mass destruction, because of the, certitude that the Iranians will have, in addition to chemical and biological weapons, nuclear weapons, in due course, if not in fairly short order?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, the entire Iran nuclear deal is a farce. It's not stopping them from getting nuclear weapons. All it did was hand them untold boatloads of cash to buy arms with, and they will inevitably, if we don't stop them, acquire nuclear weapons.
Yeah, and the means by which to deliver them over long distances. Hey, Sam, I noticed in your bio that you served as an assistant attorney general for the state of Washington. It was the attorney general of the state of Washington that, of course, brought to grief the first executive order that Donald Trump issued to try to exercise his authority over who comes into this country, specifically from seven problematic nations. Knowing what you do about the government of the state of Washington, the attorney general, the impetus behind that effort, and more to the point, what you know about the world and the kind of people who would love to come here to do us harm, what do you make of all of this, Sam? What should we make in particular of the present efforts to sort of recover from the setback in court at the hands of the attorney general of Washington state?
Well, I think it's a good thing that they decided to take two steps back, they being the Trump administration, and come up with an executive order that was a little more tightly drawn and prepared to stand legal challenges. I think that was wise. I find it very disconcerting that we have attorney generals, frankly, all over the country, including, I think, attorney general in my own state of Maryland, who seem to think that it's their job to try to obstruct the president of the United States and interfere in how we conduct foreign affairs and national security. I can't think of anything that is more clearly in the wheelhouse of the federal government and not something that the states should be trying to drive from their level. So very troubling.
And do you think especially that's the case because, as a general rule, there is a lack of understanding, let alone mastery, of the national security challenges that we are facing as a nation? Is it, in your experience in state government, is that typically a problem because it's simply not part of the portfolio of your average attorney general, for example?
Yeah, well, that's clearly the case. Nobody at that level is going to have the expertise to really understand the threats. But then clearly there's an ideological element here and where we're just ignoring reality. I mean, if I've got 1,000 Syrian refugees trying to come in the country, I have no doubt that most of them, have no intention of doing harm when they get here. But the reality is I have zero capacity to actually fact check their stories. These fantasies about doing deep background checks are just that. You tell me you're a grocer from Aleppo. What is my capacity to confirm that story? None. There are no record systems. I have no relations with the Syrian government. The Syrian government doesn't even have access to that information. I mean, most of the time, all they do is ask these people questions and then accept their story. That doesn't constitute vetting.
Yeah. You know, what I've also been told, Sam Faddis, is that they typically, these refugees particularly, are given interviews by two other entities before they get to a federal government employee. One is the refugee division of the United Nations, and the other is the so-called voluntary agency that's bringing them into this country and paid to do so. So by the time the government gets their hands on these guys, they've probably been pretty well trained on how to not answer any questions that might be incriminating or keep them out. Sam, thank you so much for your service to our country. Again, Sam Faddis has been our guest. We are grateful to you for it and that you continue to render now through your writings and appearances in media. Check out his book, Beyond Repair, The Decline and Fall of the CIA. Thanks again, Sam. We'll talk with you soon. Next up, my colleague Jim Henson joins us from the Center for Security Policy. We'll talk about the executive order and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We're joined by the Executive Vice President of the Center for Security Policy, Jim Henson, a former Green Beret, a man of considerable derring-do and great acumen, who I'm very pleased to say frequently guest hosts this program and is much admired for his service in that role as well, especially by me. Jim, welcome back. It's good to have you.
Always a pleasure, Frank.
Fresh from an appearance at Fox and Friends this morning, talking about the executive order that the president recently issued, revising his previous executive order about immigration. Tell me a little bit about your thoughts, Jim, as to the changes in the first instance and the importance of this revised executive order to our national security.
I think the most important thing, Frank, is that from a legal and constitutional perspective, activist liberal judges in the Ninth Circuit aside, his first order was perfectly fine. There was nothing in it that needed to be changed to pass muster, but because of the fact that he can't be certain that that's going to be the case, they went ahead and made some changes. They took Iraq off the list. They actually made sure to say specifically that it did not apply to permanent visa holders or legal permanent residents or anyone already holding a visa. They carved out a bunch of ways to get exemptions for people on diplomatic missions and other things where, you know, the government might have an interest in having people, some people from those countries, come here for a particular reason. But other than that, the order, the gist of it remains the same. They want to stop importing jihadists. And the way to do that is to go ahead and take places where we know they are and not allow them from there.
Well, let me ask you about that, Jim, because when you say stop importing jihadists, which seems to me to be a perfectly sensible, in fact, very necessary thing to do, that gives rise to the argument that we keep hearing, notably now, from an Islamist in Hawaii, who apparently will have his attorney general out there getting the government back into court on this new executive order. We're told, well, that's a Muslim ban, and that's unconstitutional, that's illegal. Your thoughts on that?
I'd be curious to see where in the world they managed to find the word Muslim, Islam, or religion in any fashion in this executive order at all. What they're doing is engaging in mind reading and deciding that because this will have an effect on some Muslims, because the countries involved are majority Muslim countries, therefore, it is designed to be a Muslim ban. But you're getting so deep into the psychic tea leaf reading, and that's not the job of attorneys general or judges or anyone else. The president is charged with our national security. This law that he's using to take this power specifically granted him from Congress the judgment about what particular classes of aliens might present a threat to the United States and gave him the right and charge to stop them from entering. So I think that piece of it is going to fail miserably. That's more of a political talking point than a legal one. But again, let's see what the collection of liberal judges does next.
Well, and I think it's also important to note that if you are a jihadist and you are seeking the destruction of the property, the people, the government of the United States, you may or may not be considering yourself a Muslim practicing your faith, but you are certainly practicing a seditious totalitarian ideology, and we have plenty of precedent for presidents excluding such people from the United States. That certainly seems to be in order at the moment. Hey, Jim, I'm going to be talking a little bit more about this with Sam Faddis, as I am several of these topics, but let me ask you about one other issue that's arisen of late, and that is this leak by WikiLeaks of apparently enormous amounts of information, some of it highly classified, about American electronic intelligence sources and methods. What's your take on what's been done there and the implications of it?
It's horrifying to see the actual practices that our intelligence agencies use to spy on our enemies and keep us all safe exposed at all ever. I think this is one of those cases where the recent actions that have come to light as far as how the Obama administration was spying on the Trump campaign and other things they were up to, normally I would be 100% in favor of all of the particularly cool methods that came to light. But now we're finding out that some of those may have been used improperly and may actually be a threat to U.S. citizens in ways they shouldn't. So I think you've got kind of a double whammy. You know, it points out just how much the government can do against whoever they don't like at the time. And it also points out that the capabilities we have to keep the country safe are now no longer as effective as they were because this organization decided that exposing things was more than making the world safe.
So did I hear you say that you're concerned that these techniques have, in fact, been used against American citizens at this point? Is that something that jumps out at you from those pages?
Sure makes you wonder. You know, I don't know that there have been any accusations around the Obama wiretapping of Trump that related to the CIA's activities in that regard. So I think that maybe, you know, it was the FBI, it was FISA courts, it was those kind of things. They were doing the investigations, which at some level is proper. We'll find out later if they stepped over that line and crimes were committed. But the idea that the CIA has these capabilities and we've got all the leaks that came out of the CIA that were used against the Trump campaign makes you wonder if the same rogue operators inside the CIA are willing to do those things against U.S. citizens right now. I think we need a thorough swamp draining of our intelligence community.
Jim, do you have any doubt that there was, in fact, surveillance conducted against the Trump campaign and perhaps against the candidate himself?
No, I think it absolutely happened. I think all of the denials have been crafted in a way to say President Obama didn't order Donald Trump's phone tapped. And that's the one thing they say.
In Trump Tower.
Exactly. So the FISA warrants they got, they were the first one which was denied, should be embarrassing to anyone because they're almost never denied. So it shows they probably were overstepping largely there. And the one which appears to have been granted allowed them to look at Trump's associates. And by using the FISA court essentially in a way to say we're looking at foreign intelligence, but actually what they were doing, it appears, was using it to look at Trump's associates. And then those things were leaked to damage the Trump campaign. This needs a thorough investigation to see just how far they went.
Yeah. Jim, lastly, and very quickly, I know you've spent time in the Green Beret looking at and worrying about North Korea. What do you make of these missiles that they've been firing towards Japan, at least in the Sea of Japan, and the steps that have been taken to date to try to protect South Korea against some of them coming their way?
Yeah, they're stepping it up, and it's hard to tell why. You know, you had the assassination of Kim Jong-nam. You've got China even telling them, hey, look, guys, you need to knock this off a little bit. I think relations there are a little sour, and it's always been a question of how much crazier does each generation of Kims in North Korea get? And it just appears that their most recent guy is the craziest yet. And I don't know if the Chinese have the ability to stop him from doing things. They certainly have the ability to stop him from receiving the money he needs to run his country. And so that may be the next step they need to take. But what he does then, I don't think anybody knows.
Yeah. One thing seems to me to be absolutely bankable is we're going to need more and better missile defenses, not just the relatively modest system we've placed in South Korea, but some for ourselves as well. And this is a priority we've been told of the Trump administration. I hope they'll get about it. And in particular, that they'll talk about draining the swamp. There really needs to be a wholesale cleaning out of the missile defense agencies. Folks, as I think we've spent an enormous amount of money with not very much to show for it, and we've got to be better equipped to deal with not just the North Korean missile threat, frankly, but that of China, Russia, hypersonic missiles, and maneuvering warheads and the like. So We'll be following this closely, Jim Henson. I know you will be participating in doing so at the Center for Security Policy. Thanks so much for the work you do now and you have done in the past for our country. Come back to us again very soon. Next up, we'll talk with Carolyn Glick, a columnist for the Jerusalem Post. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're joined by Carolyn Glick, an extraordinary resource in the war of ideas, a columnist for the Jerusalem Post, the author of two extraordinary books, Shackled Warrior, Israel and the Global Jihad, and The Israeli Solution, a one-state plan for peace in the Middle East. Carolyn, it is always a delight to have you with us. Thank you very much for finding a few minutes for us. You have been contributing mightily to our understanding of what is going on in the Middle East at the moment, as well as the U.S.-Israeli relationship. And I wanted to take stock with you about something you've written recently about the Hamas war and the lessons that should be learned both by Israel and, I would argue, by the rest of us. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Well, last week, the headlines in Israel were dominated by the government's controller report on the war between Israel and Hamas that took place in the summer of 2014. And the report itself was centered mainly on Israel's tactics for combating Hamas's underground tunnel complex that were used to penetrate into Israeli territory from Gaza. And the larger issue of the nature of the war itself was really disregarded by the controller in this report that was supposed to be the last word on the war, but it hid more than it revealed, because you can't understand what happened in that war without understanding it in the strategic context of regional developments in the Middle East and in terms of American-Israel relations under the Obama administration.
Let's talk very quickly about a couple of those regional developments, because they have very significant implications. The rise of Iran, thanks to Barack Obama's transfer of over $100 billion, and its activities now increasingly in Syria. It's been described as a sort of Shiite crescent. But it also has apparently caused considerable concern on the part of Israel about what Iran and its proxy Hezbollah are up to in proximity to the Israeli border with Syria. Give us a flavor of how that looks from your perspective.
The thing is that as part of Obama's appeasement of Iran, one of the things that he was doing was shielding its proxies, Hezbollah and Hamas, in 2014, as well as its ally, the Muslim Brotherhood, from any sort of military defeat at the hands of Israel in 2014 and since. And so the Obama administration during that war was really siding with Hamas against Israel. And that was really the context that the war was fought in, with Israel trying to fight with the Americans, siding with our enemy in time of war. And then in regards to what's happening today, you know, we see that Netanyahu is flying to Russia tomorrow to meet with Vladimir Putin to discuss developments in the southern Golan Heights, because the Iranians and Hezbollah have been trying to take over the border area with Israel to develop another conventional threat against Israel from Syria along the lines of what they have in southern Lebanon. And that would be a real complication for Israel in terms of our national security. We have a land border with Iran, essentially, in Lebanon, and then we expand it to Syria. So he's going to Moscow tomorrow to try to convince Vladimir Putin to prevent that from happening.
Carolyn, what is the latest on the Jordanian king's hold on power?
Well, you know, Jordan is really a protectorate of the United States and of Israel. The Hashemite Kingdom owes its existence to Israel's willingness to protect it and to American deployment of its forces, its special forces in Jordan. Today, Jordan's population over the past decade has expanded by a third, from 4 million to 6 million, with 2 million refugees from Iraq and from Syria, and God only knows what their allegiances are to. So they face a panoply of threats to their own existence inside of Jordan. And this is part of the wider context, which is that the Sunnis, it was King Abdullah of Jordan who coined the term the Shiite Crescent, extending into the Levant from Iran during the Iraq War, when he was talking about how the United States were taking this sort of facile attitude towards Iran's operations inside of Iraq during the war, and warning against it. And his warning was borne out, in fact. And so just to backstop for a second, so the 2014 war, the Sunnis recognized that they were facing a threat from the Muslim Brotherhood and from Iranian proxies to their existence. We saw it, of course, in the Egyptian revolution and counter-revolution with the Muslim Brother rising and falling within the space of a couple of years in Egypt, and the United States backing the Muslim Brotherhood. So we're seeing this massive destabilization of the Sunni Arab world since 2011, and all of the regimes that are most allied in the United States' camp traditionally, the Saudis, the Jordanians, the Egyptians, and others in the Gulf in particular, are facing devastating threats both from Sunni jihadists, Salafists, and also from the Iranians that are very destabilizing and endanger really not only Israel, of course, and the Sunnis, but also the wider world, because to the extent that these people are able to control territory in the Middle East, they have used in the past, continue to use today, and will use to the future these bases of operations as a means to penetrate into the West and to endanger Western interests and national security.
Yeah, very ominous indeed. Our guest is Carolyn Glick of the Jerusalem Post. She is also a senior fellow for Middle East Affairs at the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I'm very pleased to say a visiting and much valued colleague of ours at the Center for Security Policy as well. Carolyn, when you look at this, vortex of instability, you mentioned Egypt, and one of the places where we've seen some relief, really, from the growing danger to Israel has been the el-Sisi regime's seeming determination to cooperate with Israel. That's being sorely tested now in Sinai, and the threat that we're seeing to both countries, really, from various factions of the sort of global jihad movement, the Sharia supremacists there. Would you just give us an update on what's happening in the Sinai at the moment?
Well, I mean, you know, and that again goes back to your original question about my column last Friday, which is that, you know, the most extraordinary thing from a regional perspective that happened during the war between Israel and Hamas was that Egypt and then Saudi Arabia and the UAE sided openly with Israel in that war against Hamas. And they did because Hamas is the logistical partner and operational partner to varying degrees over time with the Salafist Islamic State terrorists in the Sinai, and that are endangering, that are waging a war against the Sisi regime in Egypt. So that Hamas is very much part of that whole jihad caliphate empire that wants to take over the Islamic world and wants to take over the world. And they understood that if Israel failed to stand up to Hamas and broke down in any way and gave it anything that it could consider a victory in that war, then they would all be imperiled by them. So they openly stood with Israel. And today we are seeing an unprecedented amount of military cooperation between the Israeli military and the Egyptian military in countering the Salafist forces in the Sinai. And so, yeah, we do see an enormous amount of operational cooperation between Israel and Egypt. And again, you know, so long as, and we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. Sisi could fall. The most populous Arab country, 90 million people in Egypt, could really become a vortex of something very, very ugly. So I think it's a very primary Israeli interest and American interest to protect the Sisi regime and to help Sisi to fight and to emerge victorious in this war. In the Sinai and also in northern, and also in along the Libyan border, you know, because Libya also has been taken over and been transformed into this failed state where you have ISIS in charge of very large swaths of Libyan territory, so a former Libyan territory.
Again, in part a function of the Obama legacy.
It is all the Obama legacy, and it's important to keep these in mind and bear them in mind. And I think a turning point in that was 2014 war between Israel and Hamas. And we have to learn the lessons of that war going forward, both from an Israeli perspective and from an American perspective, because understanding what happened 3 years ago is really a key to understanding what we need to be doing going forward in terms of containing with the goal of destroying these terror enclaves in the Middle East.
Indeed. Carolyn Glick, we have to let you go with that. Thank you very much, as always, for all that you do to inform and educate the rest of us. I congratulate you once again on Shackled Warrior and The Israeli Solution. Required reading, folks. Next up, Joseph Humar joins us to talk about how Hezbollah is not just a threat to Israel, but to us here in the United States as well. That and more straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We're joined by Joseph Humeyer, a man who these days serves as the executive director of the highly regarded Center for a Secure Free Society, formerly with the Atlas Economic Research Foundation, and also an 8-year veteran of the United States Marine Corps, which entailed combat tours in Iraq and Liberia. He is also the author of an important and highly topical book, Iran's Strategic Penetration of Latin America, topic we want to visit with him about, as a matter of fact. Joseph Humeyer, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Thanks, Frank. Always a pleasure to be on.
So there's an increasing level of awareness, it seems, and a heightened concern about not just what Iran is doing elsewhere, as we've been talking about with our previous guests, Joseph, but also what it's up to here, both in its own right. When I say here, I mean in our hemisphere, but also really literally here in our own country. What we are looking at in terms of the involvement of both the government of Iran and its proxy Hezbollah throughout this region, what can you shed light on that we ought to be concerned about?
I think the most important thing for your listeners to pay attention to right now is Venezuela. They're all over. Iran and Hezbollah have presence all over Latin America, I'd say all over the Western Hemisphere, including the United States and Canada. But more precariously, they've advanced tremendously in Venezuela. The appointment of the new Venezuelan vice president, Tarek El Asami, was a power move on behalf of the Iranians in conjunction with the Cubans to essentially take control of that country. And if you look carefully at what the new vice president's doing, consolidating the executive power, basically putting his proxies or his loyalists in different agencies and different ministries, they're essentially consolidating their power. And in Venezuela, the question is, how far are they going to go and to what end? Venezuela is a country in a very dire situation economically, politically, and at any moment could break into any kind of civil conflict or potentially even a civil war. You made a good point in saying that the Iranian presence is spread throughout the hemisphere, including in our own country here in the United States, and I would include also up north in Canada. And that's an important point in that, you know, through the research that I've done on their presence in Latin America, I noticed a lot of the connections between certain countries in Latin America with North America, with the United States and Canada. I'll give you a small example. When the former Canadian government under the Harper administration shut down the Iranian embassy in Ottawa in 2012, if you remember, they closed diplomatic relations with the Iranians in 2012. When they closed the embassy in Ottawa, instead of the Iranians that were stationed at that embassy, instead of them going back to Tehran or going back to the Middle East, they actually just shuffled a lot of them down to Cuba and other embassies and some into Ecuador and other embassies in Latin America, which is indicative to me that they see the Western Hemisphere as one hemisphere. So whatever operations they're conducting in Venezuela, in Ecuador, in Mexico, and other parts of Latin America, it's in conjunction with whatever they're doing here in the United States and up north in Canada, and it's a cohesive strategy.
And to the extent that we know the thrust of that strategy, Joseph Humeyer, is there any question in your mind that it is hostile to us and a threat?
No, I believe so. I believe they, you know, Iran, I think we have to couch their politics in the lens of a revolution. I mean, it's essentially a revolution. It's a revolution with borders. It plays the facade of a Wisconsin type of nation state. But in reality, they think they act like revolutionaries, and revolutionaries need enemies. And their enemies, I believe, are in the United States. Anything they do on this side of the world, things that they do in the Middle East sometimes are directed towards Israel. They might be directed towards Saudi Arabia and other that are more immediate challenges in their near abroad. But things they do on this side of the world are, by and large, in my estimation, geared against the United States. They're part of an effort to delegitimize the United States and diminish our influence in the Western Hemisphere.
Okay, so Joseph Humeyer, let's talk a little bit about some of those things that they're doing in Venezuela and in Mexico that have as their purpose undermining and perhaps seriously endangering this country.
Yeah,
Well, I think one of the most precarious things that they've been doing, especially as of lately, is the positioning of Hezbollah operatives. So Hezbollah, this is a big debate within the defense community. You know, the folks that work with Hezbollah in Latin America, how much are they properly embedded into the Hezbollah hierarchy in terms of an operational structure? And how many of them are just collaborators that are basically making money off the drug trade and have Lebanese or Syrian connections? And so they help Hezbollah move some of this money. There's definitely an element that are collaborative. I mean, the Syrian and Lebanese diasporas in Latin America that predate the birth of Hezbollah. So there's definitely an element that I think is collaboration. But more important, I think, especially in the last decade, we've seen the positioning of Hezbollah operatives from the Middle East. I'll give you one example. I'm involved in a terrorism trial in Peru, in Lima, Peru, where an individual, a Lebanese national, was sent to Peru from Lebanon in 2014. Actually, he was sent in 2013. He was arrested in 2014 because the Peruvian police found him with over 1,000 pictures of critical infrastructure in his electronic devices and nitroglycerin on his left hand and within his apartment. This individual was not part of that collaborative network. He was not even a part of that drug trafficking network. He was a jihadist. He was an individual that was looking to plan an attack and potentially carry out a bombing.
In Peru?
He's now under arrest in Peru, in Lima, Peru, in 2014. He's now under trial. And I think within a month, we'll know if they convict him. And what they would convict him of is not of, you know, any kind of other criminal charges. They would convict him of membership in a terrorist organization. That would be a de facto designation of Hezbollah as a terrorist organization in Peru, which would be a precedent, a legal precedent in Latin America.
And you are serving as an expert witness, I assume, on the case?
Correct. I'm an expert witness to that trial. I testified back in October. I testified again last month. And so I think the trial is pretty much coming to its final phase. So hopefully this will lead to a conviction.
And an important precedent, as you say. Joseph, let me just quickly, on passports that the Venezuelan government is issuing to some of these Middle Eastern sorts, whether they're out of Iran or Lebanon or elsewhere, how serious a problem does that represent? And also, if you would, talk a little bit about the tunnels that Hezbollah is expert in building in South Lebanon, notably, and I guess in Gaza as well for Hamas, but apparently on our own border as well.
Yeah, thanks, Frank, for reminding me of that. The passport issue is very precarious. It's very important and it's urgent. You know, I don't think I thought of it initially because it's been going on for so long. The service of providing immigration documents to members of Lebanese Hezbollah, or at least suspected members of Lebanese Hezbollah, has been going on for decades. It's really took an uptick after 2008 when the now Venezuelan vice minister was then Minister of Interior. And he essentially created a pipeline through the Ministry of Interior of Venezuela to allow all kinds of militants from the Middle East, but namely Hezbollah members, to receive this documentation. The most concerning aspect of it is not just the fact that they got a passport. It's actually the complete creation of a dual identity, a chain of custody of immigration documents or identification documents, including birth certificates, driver's license, national IDs, visas, all kinds of, so that you can essentially establish somebody as if they were born in another country. So you could take someone from Lebanon and you could essentially establish him in Venezuela and create a legitimate record of him, a documentation, a record in Venezuela. So that for U.S. authorities is impossible to track. I mean, if we get a visa application from somebody from Venezuela, quote unquote, we won't know if that person was originally from Lebanon. There's no way for us to really have that unless we have a whistleblower or somebody working human intelligence on the ground. So that's a really big concern in light of all the immigration security challenges that we face as a nation.
And very quickly, the tunnels under the Mexican border?
Yeah, that's something that, you know, I've looked into since about 2002. There's been an increasing presence of Hezbollah members in Mexico in correlation with essentially the building of very elaborate tunnels that move particularly through the El Paso corridor in Texas that go into El Paso to what's that state called? Well, I can't remember the other side of
Juarez
on the Mexican side, but Juarez, exactly. The Juarez El Paso corridor, which was at the time Sinaloa territory. And those tunnels have electrical systems. They have ventilation systems. I mean, it's far more sophisticated than what the Mexicans had the capability, the drug cartels had the capability to do in the past. And it's largely suspected that Hezbollah has provided them because it correlates with the same time that Hezbollah became increasingly present in that country.
Yeah, and we know that they have considerable experience doing this sort of engineering work to the detriment of our friends in Israel and others. We have to leave it at that. Joseph Heumeier, thank you so much for the great work you do at the Center for a Secure, Free Society and for joining us from time to time. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. And the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.